Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 21st, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will hear a Supreme Court preview on the case Packingham v. North Carolina. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Jonathan Sherman, partner at Boies, Schiller & Flexner, and Melissa Arbers Sherry, partner at Latham & Watkins. I will turn it over to Melissa to get us started. After opening remarks, we will go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Melissa. The floor is yours.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. So we are going to talk about North Carolina versus Packingham. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about what the case is about, how it got to the Supreme Court, and then we can dive into some of the legal issues. And I'm going to talk a little bit about an amicus brief that that Latham filed on the side of North Carolina as we walk through that. So I'm coming to this from that vantage point in particular. And so starting with what is at issue in this case, so what is the question presented? This is all about a North Carolina statute that was passed in 2008. And the statute essentially makes it a felony for a registered sex offender to access social networking sites where there's knowingly children that have access to the same sites. And the question is whether that violates the First Amendment. And so North Carolina passed this law in 2008. And what happened in this particular case is a previously convicted sex offender who was registered accessed Facebook and had a Facebook post to the effect of saying, I think it was God is good, because he was able to get out of, I think it was a traffic ticket. Police officers noticed that he was on Facebook that violated the North Carolina statute, and so he was prosecuted for that. And it went up through the North Carolina state courts, the question being whether there was a First Amendment violation, or at least that was the primary question. Went all the way up to the North Carolina Supreme Court, who said that there was no First Amendment violation. Packingham sought cert, the court granted the case, and it is now going to be argued before the court on this coming Monday on February 27th. And so there's a number of different legal arguments in the case, all centering around the First Amendment issue. One question, though, is a statutory one that is sort of embedded in this case and in a lot of the briefing in this case is, what is a social networking site? The North Carolina statute does have a somewhat detailed and perhaps confusing definition of what constitutes a social networking site. And so one of the debates, both in the North Carolina courts and in the Supreme Court briefing, is what does that cover? Everyone agrees it covers the traditional true social networking sites like Facebook, for example. But there's a debate as to whether it goes further. Does it cover the New York Times? Does it cover Amazon? Does it cover Google? All in the briefs, you'll find it replete with references to a variety of different websites that may or may not be covered by the definition. North Carolina's position on this is that it is limited to quote-unquote true social networking sites, and there's an explanation based on the statute as to why that's the case. The other side has argued either it's not so limited or at least it's pretty darn vague, and so it's difficult to figure out whether it is so limited. So that's one of the sort of statutory issues in this case. And then the argument sort of proceeds from there. If it is limited to true social networking sites, is there still a First Amendment problem with the North Carolina law as written? And, you know, even if you assume true social networking, it does definitively exclude things like chat rooms. It excludes non-commercial social networking sites. And so there's questions as to whether maybe it's too narrow in its focus. And then there is the issue of the fact that it is limited to registered sex offenders. And so one of the questions going back and forth in the case is whether that is, is that a speaker-based restriction for First Amendment purposes? Does that make it better or does that make it worse? It includes all registered sex offenders, so even those that haven't been previously convicted of a crime that involved minors. Is that a problem? That's one of the arguments being made. And it is limited to registered sex offenders, so it doesn't include other people who are, may potentially commit sex offenses who aren't already registered or haven't previously been convicted of a sex offense. So that's one issue, the statutory interpretation issue. The other really big question, doctrinal question, at least getting into the real issue, is what test do you apply? So the Supreme Court has all different First Amendment tests depending on what sort of restriction it is. There's time, place, and manner. There's a difference between conduct and speech. There's content-based, content-neutral, et cetera. The North Carolina Supreme Court treated it as a restriction on conduct with an incidental impact on speech. North Carolina is not defending that interpretation before the Supreme Court. Instead, it's arguing that this is a time, place, and manner restriction. It's content neutral. It's not saying what you can say or can't say. It's just about access to these sites. And really, it's just telling you where you can't be. So it's a time, place, and manner restriction, which means you apply intermediate scrutiny. The Packingham side, argues against that, but their primary argument is regardless of what level of scrutiny applies, it still fails. And so most of the discussion, once you get past those two threshold issues, is about whether the North Carolina statute is narrowly tailored and whether there are less restrictive alternatives. And that's kind of the meat, I think, of the case. And so once you get into that, then the conversation is over, whether it's too broad, whether it's over-inclusive, whether it's under-inclusive. It seems to prohibit a lot of speech is the argument being made on one side, and that there's a lot of things you use, social networking sites that are not problematic. There's certainly a lot of people, even registered sex offenders, who use social networking sites for totally proper purposes, this case being one example. There are other ways if you're worried about stopping child sex abuse. There are other ways to do it. You could actually focus on the conduct itself and prohibit, for example, solicitation online. You could limit it to cases where you're accessing these sites for an improper purpose. And there's a whole laundry list of other examples, Packingham would argue, where you could achieve the same result or at least close to the same result in a way that doesn't restrict as much speech. And so those are the sorts of arguments that are going back and forth. Now, like I said in the beginning, we Latham filed an amicus brief in this case for two organizations, for Stop Child Predators and for Shared Hope International. Both of the organizations are basically dedicated to stopping child sex exploitation and abuse and child sex trafficking. And so in our brief, we focused on three issues. One, we wanted to explain to the court how social networking sites work and why they pose a special danger for children. Two, we wanted to document that there really is a problem that North Carolina was trying to address, which is the fact that sex offenders and potential sex offenders use these social networking sites to recruit kids, to groom them, and to otherwise target them. And then three, we wanted to explain why North Carolina reasonably focused on registered sex offenders as a class and why some of the less restrictive alternatives that have been suggested really would be also less effective. And so those were the three main points we sort of fleshed out in the brief. On the first point about, how social networking sites work and why they pose a special danger, there are a number of sort of studies and data showing, and I don't think it's that surprising, it's not surprising to me at least, that teenagers in particular and children more generally use these social networking sites on a very regular basis. They post a lot of information online. They post a lot of personal information online. And they sometimes do so without regard for the privacy of that information. So we spend some time sort of going through the stats on that and the details on that, how many teenagers, for example, are willing to put their cell phone number online, where they're physically located at any given time. And so really just the wealth of personal information that's accessible through these sites with respect to kids. As far as the real problem that North Carolina was trying to address, there's also a lot of studies and sort of documentation on how sex offenders and sex traffickers use these social networking sites, at least as a first step to target their victims, either in a passive way by gathering information or in a more active way by actually using them as forms and ways to solicit kids online. One of the examples that we talk about in the brief and that I hadn't been aware of before doing this is something that's called sextortion, which is basically individuals who make contact with children online, eventually get them to provide something compromising like a nude picture or the like, and then use that as a way to extort them, to blackmail them, you know, threaten to release it to friends, threaten to release it to family, to get them to do other things online that are, you know, various different forms of sexual exploitation. And so going through sort of both the examples of that happening and some stats and data with respect to that. And then finally on the third point about why registered sex offenders, just sort of explaining, which the Supreme Court has recognized in previous cases, just that sex offenders as a class are more likely to be recidivist offenders than others. And also going through, and North Carolina does this in far more detail, why some of the less restrictive alternatives are also just less effective. The fact is that sex offenses against children are a problem and have been a problem for some time. And states and the federal government have come up with a variety of different means to get at this problem, including the most basic, which is obviously criminalizing the underlying sex offense. But that hasn't been successful, and so states and the feds have tried other things. There are, registry laws in all 50 states. There are a number of other, and we can talk about this more, but there are a number of other restrictions that are put on sex offenders, both as conditions of supervised release or probation or parole, but also restrictions that extend beyond. And so, you know, this was North Carolina's latest effort. They obviously have a registry. There's other, there's sex offenses on the book, and there's other things that exist in North Carolina and in other states. And so this is just sort of their latest attempt to plug another hole and, importantly, to stop a sex offense before it happens. This is a way to, a preventative measure to get at it early, whereas a lot of the other, quote-unquote, less restrictive alternatives, you wouldn't really be able to stop it until it was too late, until there was already a child victim. And so that's basically what we focused on in the brief. There's a lot of other amicus briefs and certainly the party briefs, but I think that's a fairly good start to get the conversation going, and I will turn it over to Jonathan.
Thank you. Thank you, Melissa. We at Boy Shiller represented several social networking trade groups, you might call them, such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others. And our task was to sort of answer the questions that our client's task is often to answer a lot of the questions that the social problems Melissa was talking about North Carolina tries to address through different means. We, for example, our clients, for example, are as concerned about privacy as they are about the First Amendment. The problem with this particular statute is that it's not just that it goes so far. It's not just that it is so broad. Melissa did a very nice job of explaining kind of the limitations on the statute from a doctrinal point of view. But sort of the thing that was most frustrating about this from a First Amendment perspective is that as a doctrinal matter, the law has long chosen not to approach these sorts of criminal problems this way. There's a fascinating kind of, I guess we would call it a meme, that has trailed First Amendment law in this area since the 50s. It's about the kids, is what I've heard many First Amendment lawyers call it. And they don't say that in a way that's critical or demeaning. They don't say that in a way that's intended to trivialize the interests that Melissa's clients represent. But they do say that in order to identify that the principal problem in these cases is usually in overstating the exception to ordinary First Amendment law that involving kids as a countervailing interest often does. That often warps the doctrinal, the really well-settled doctrinal approach to cases where, as in this case, the state is acknowledging we're dealing with speech, or at least with their arguments about whether access is speech. But you know, in calling it a time, place, and manner restriction, they are they're trying. They're not really saying it isn't speech, and what they're trying to do is get to this level of intermediate scrutiny where the court uses these sort of fictions that we learned in law school, supposedly, at least we learned in law school, answer the question before it's even analyzed. What you don't see in this briefing, and what you don't see the state doing, is thinking about this as thinking about this problem the way you do with most First Amendment cases. In most First Amendment cases that involve, you can call them access cases, you can call them speech cases, but that involve sort of core speech, the New York Times, Facebook, places where the statute on its face, you know, it says it's a felony for a registered sex offender, which doesn't mean someone who it means anyone who's required to register. It's not clear whether that covers a future sexual criminal. It isn't necessarily limited to children. To access for any purpose of any kind, any website that falls within this statutory band, and that's pretty much everything. That's Google, Bing, Yahoo, the Raleigh News and Observer, the New York Times, the Washington Post, TripAdvisor, WebMD, SoundCloud, Macy's, Quora, WordPress. You can go on and on, because all of these are places where you can corner a child or you can find a way to communicate with a child. That's the nature of the medium. The doctrinal answer to statutes that tend to attack speech that brazenly, that directly, is to start with a massive presumption against regulation, and then to require the state to justify, to work hard at coming up with solutions. And it's never perfect. This debate that Melissa sort of articulated, both sides of, I thought, really fairly, this is really not very different from the debate in Reno, which was the first sort of internet case in 1993, Reno versus ACLU, which some of you may remember, in which the Supreme Court, almost as stridently as one could imagine, and in the context of a different era where, you know, there had just been a debate at the court about whether cable was to be accorded sort of cable network speech was to be accorded strict scrutiny, restrictions on those. Why broadcast television now, so many years removed from FCC Pacifica, should not have the same level of restriction, of scrutiny, rather. And in that case, in Reno, the same arguments were made. You can't get at all the speech. The internet is a scary place. It's sort of the Wild West. Anyone with technical skill can take advantage of children. And the court, pretty much, I think unanimously, maybe there was one vote against it, but it was a very strong opinion, at the Supreme Court rejected the idea that when you start with the internet, rejected the idea that you could balance your way through these problems, which is really what the intermediate scrutiny test does. A time, place, and manner restriction. I mean, just to sort of review quickly, right? You have strict scrutiny. You have to show an extremely tight connection, almost perfect fit, between the statute and the wrongdoing it's trying to cover. The rational basis scrutiny, which everybody knows, if it's sort of a rational approach to a problem, then it is going to be likely going to be upheld. Strict scrutiny, likely fatal, Gerald Guther's famous phrase. And intermediate scrutiny is this sort of balancing land where we go when we're not quite sure about whether we want to apply a sort of a clear and hard principle, when we think we need to balance. And the problem with this case is that it presents so many opportunities for the exploitation of children, the exploitation of anyone through through not just the internet, but the two-way nature of the internet, the chat room sort of nature, the disguised identity sort of nature. The problem that everyone should have with this statute is that we live in a society, at least I think we do, we're going through a debate about that, I suppose, outside this, in this presidency, where you presume that something that regulates the speech of places that prevents access to the sorts of information provided by the entities I listed before, that's untouchable, absent an emergency. It's as close to the prior restraint test, the sort of it never happens kind of test, as you can get, because we make an assumption that as technology evolves, as choices evolve, in this case, law enforcement techniques evolve, you're able to attack the social problem incrementally in a way that doesn't destroy millions of people's access to this sort of thing. The gentleman at the heart of this case said something like, as you said, Melissa, he thanked God because I think it was Facebook, it may have been a different, but it was that type of thing, Twitter or something like that. He thanked God that the police had decided not to prosecute him for a parking ticket or a speeding infraction. The thing that got him to have to register as a registered sex offender, was 20 years ago. It was when he was 21 years old, and he was having a relationship with a 13-year-old. He was not charged at that time with battery, rape. He was charged with a variant, if I recall correctly, of kind of statutory rape. And the record doesn't, at least my level of knowledge of the record, doesn't go as far as it should. But this is exactly the kind of person who, he's not committing a sexual infraction, or he doesn't intend to commit a crime related to sex. His actions have nothing to do with anything related to interest in children or interest in sex crime or even romance. He's thanking God that he does not get prosecuted for a parking ticket 20 years after what he may well have viewed and what his victim may well have viewed as a consensual relationship. There are a vast number of people required to register as sex offenders. They have rights once they have finished their penalties. There are residual restrictions, as Melissa said, but this was not one of those. This was not a violation of a residual restriction. This was like a second punishment for having, thank God, that he didn't have a parking ticket on Facebook. That's the kind of mistake that we have already chosen we would rather not see made than the mistake in the other direction. That's how we have chosen to live as a society. We might not. We might have a different society where the presumption is that if anyone, if there are children that have access to social networking sites that they shouldn't have access to, let's say, that in all such cases, we will carve out from the ordinary view towards speech, those kinds of cases. The statute doesn't do that, but even if it were just that, even if it were limited to that, children, any minor, we have something like that already. That's why you're not allowed to say, the seven dirty words on television. But the reason you're not allowed to say the seven dirty words on television is because, as a social matter, everyone knows the reason you're not allowed to say that on television, on broadcast television, is that when that case was decided, Pacifica, we lived in an era where there were six channels, four networks, and it was absolutely inescapable that children in mass would be watching, watching television during the hours in which the FCC, which continues to regulate broadcast television this way, regulated it. But we don't do that with cable. We don't do that with the internet, precisely because we've created a wide, huge number of sources of speech, and we've done that to our advantage. We would argue, right? We believe so far that the freedom associated with the doctrinal presumption that you don't regulate political speech or culturally valuable speech or art or sports scores because of a potential risk, a real risk that potentially could happen. You don't do that in a broad way. You start by assuming the state has to meet a burden, that the state has to sort of figure out where the incremental benefits are and live with the costs of this constitutional baseline. And it's the scrutiny, it's the pushing this into intermediate scrutiny that is, in this case, I don't think it can survive intermediate scrutiny. I don't think the statute will be upheld under intermediate scrutiny if that's what they apply. But if they apply intermediate scrutiny to this particular speech, or rather this particular statute, it's a major loss for the First Amendment, because it says that there are certain circumstances where the internet, where prowling around on the internet involves in effect conduct. When you press a button on a keyboard, you're not speaking. When you're seeking out information, you're not speaking. You're accessing, whether it's used as a verb or whether it's used as a noun. So for me, for First Amendment types, what makes this such a potentially terrifying case is what happens in the future when we start down the old slippery slope and we start deciding that the way you regulate speech where new technologies scare us is by identifying particular kinds of people, calling them, and this is why I was surprised in one sense to sort of see some of these groups. You can be four crime victims and still be a First Amendment person. And I'm not talking about Latham or Melissa's clients. I'm just simply sort of talking generally. This guy is a victim, arguably, in his world. He did nothing to no one and had no intent to do anything to anyone, whether young or merely a potential victim of predation. That's why the standard of review is so important here, and why if and why the potential future cases treating the internet this way, as speech as a kind of a as not special, is so disturbing. So, for whatever that's worth, that is that captures our sort of worldview of how you should approach any statute where the state is concededly regulating the kind of speech I just described.
Before we go to questions, Melissa, would you like to respond to anything Jonathan said?
Yeah, I'm happy to. I guess two thoughts, and then I think, you know, it's always more fun to actually answer questions that, you know, that you all want to ask. But I guess two things. One is on the level of scrutiny. You know, to me, that's the easier question, and obviously, you know, I come out on the other side of that. The, you know, Reno and other cases where the court has applied strict scrutiny, you know, those are content-based restrictions. I don't think there's any, you know, debate here as to whether this is content-based. It's clearly content-neutral, and that part of the issue is that it regulates access and you know, implicates situations like this one where what he was saying on Facebook was not the problem. It was the fact that he was on Facebook saying something that is what the North Carolina law is aimed at. And, you know, that may be problematic when you're talking about tailoring, but in terms of the threshold question as to what level of scrutiny applies, it's clearly a content-neutral restriction. And it's hard for me to see how, you know, at least under current doctrinal framework, you would get into a strict scrutiny type analysis. A lot of the issues in terms of whether it's too broad, what exactly it covers, to me seem more like questions once you get into whatever the correct framework is in terms of tailoring as opposed to dictating what the analysis is in the first place. And in the, you know, in the reply brief that Packingham filed, and even in the opening brief, I feel like, more so in the reply, less attention was given to trying to ratchet it up and get a higher level of scrutiny, and more attention was sort of on the, you know, regardless, it still fails under intermediate scrutiny. And maybe I'm reading too much into that, but I feel like the fight is going to be over narrow tailoring, whether that's because the court decides not to decide the level of scrutiny or not, but I think the fight's going to be within that narrow tailoring framework and maybe less so over what the correct doctrine is. And the final thing I would say on that is I completely agree on the conduct point. The North Carolina Supreme Court viewed this as conduct, not speech. I haven't wrapped my head around that analysis. I agree that it doesn't really work, and I think that's why North Carolina didn't end up advocating that in the merits briefs before the court. But I do think the time, place, and manner framework of the different available options in terms of existing case law makes the most sense, and that's what gets you into the intermediate scrutiny group.
I do want to respond. I don't disagree with you with the sort of correction on doctrine, but what has always bothered me is that, you know, there are it's very difficult in some cases to identify the distinction between something that's content-based and content-neutral. This is not, the state calls this, I think, a kind of a classical or a traditional time, place, and manner restriction, which of course it's not. It's a time, place, and manner restriction is you can protest against Trump 200 feet away from, the inauguration, but only during these hours and so forth. It may be convenient because it's hard to identify a specific content that the state was going after. It may be easier to call this a content-neutral restriction, but it is. No one has ever seen let me rephrase that. Content-based restrictions are sometimes kind of recharacterized as content-neutral restrictions. I've often had a difficult time understanding the difference between content-based and content-neutral and viewpoint-neutral restrictions. What this is interested in doing is correcting a problem that is unrelated to a particular kind of speech, but unquestionably preventing in a way that the framers of the statute could not possibly have missed, kind of content-specific activity, speech activity, right? There are ways to draft this statute that could have carved out the traditional categories that invite traditional First Amendment analysis. They chose not to. You can't make it, this is why the overbreadth doctrine is very useful here. You can't make a statute better by making it so broad that you take it outside of traditional content-based, sort of the content-based world. What they're really interested in doing is going after a kind of speech, at least I think in their head, a kind of speech that is content-based. No one, there's no First Amendment law that should prevent anyone who is a registered sex offender from visiting the New York Times. It's that sort of content-based sort of impetus by taking a group of people that are easy to marginalize socially and kind of preventing them from speaking that the statute is going after to solve a much narrower problem. If the statute had read, anyone interested in anyone with the intent of accessing the internet to speak with minors about, or to speak with anyone about sexual activity, that would have been a content-based restriction. That's essentially what the statute is trying to do. So in response, to avoid this strict scrutiny problem, the statute is written in a way that covers unquestionably protected speech. Often happens it's a sort of a clever way around the problem in RENA. It is the kind of statute that falls into the no-brainer category of content-based statutes. The kind of statute that, as drafted, ought to be viewed through that prism is sort of probably what I meant to say. But no, I don't want to factually misrepresent the nature of the statute. I do think that the statute is about the kind of censorship we think of when we tend to want to marginalize the speech of a particular group. In this case, people we think we know, who we think we can guess their activity. People like Mr. Packing. And that's where we often say it's about the kids, right? When the statute on its face has nothing to do with children. Anyway.
No, I think that's I understand the clarification, and I guess, you know, that it actually leads well into the second point I was going to make, which is in terms of the scope of the statute and you know, why I also think it's a time, place, and matter, because I think you said it, you know, prevents them from speaking, and I would add in certain places, which is where I think the time, place, and manner comes in, and it gets into what the actual scope of the statute is and whether it does cover the New York Times or whether it is limited to Facebook and whether that matters. You know, if you adopt, you know, and I should be clear here, North Carolina is arguing for the far more limited interpretation of the statute that is focused on sites like Facebook and would exclude the New York Times, would exclude Amazon, would exclude Google, and would exclude a very long laundry list of other sites on the internet. And if you adopt that more narrow construction specifically, you know, what they're really preventing is, you know, you can use access or you can use speech, but, you know, preventing that from occurring in certain places. You know, Packingham can say whatever he wants, wherever he wants, he just can't do it on Facebook, for example.
Which makes it content-based, depending on what you think about whether access is speech in this context.
Well, I mean, but I think even if you think access is speech, and I think that makes a lot of sense in this context as to why you would. But, you know, even then, he can say all the. I mean, and this might work against the statute in other respects, but as far as sort of the threshold question, he can say whatever he wants, even, you know, the bad solicitation stuff that the state is really concerned about. I mean, for better or worse, he can say that in other forums unless there's another law on the books that would prevent it. He just can't do so on Facebook. And I guess the other point I would make, and then I really will officially stop talking, is one of the things the state is focused on. It actually isn't, you know, so much, or at least not primarily, about what Packingham or others, registered sex offenders, are going to say on these sites. There's a real information gathering concern and purpose that is underlying the statute, is that as a completely passive user of Facebook, you can get a lot of information about kids, about teenagers. You can find out what they like, what they don't like. Like I said, cell phone numbers are on their physical location, information on there, who their friends are, who their family is. You can see pictures. And I recognize that, you know, too, comes with certain First Amendment interest and protections. But just to give it a full view of what North Carolina was really focused on, there is that information gathering aspect that was really concerning to them and one of the things that they were focused on.
You'll hear though, at the, I don't think you'll disagree with me, will you, that you'll hear, and then I'll shut up, at the, because I'm not, this is not really a response as much as it is just a comment. Would you agree with me that you will hear at least a fair amount of questions about either why the statute isn't as narrow as you just described its intent, written as narrowly as you just described its intent, or whether places like Facebook are news, right? What's the difference between passively scanning Facebook, Justice Kennedy might say, and passively scanning the New York Times? Well, depends on what you're using Facebook for, but that becomes much more complicated to regulate. Anyway, I don't disagree with a lot of what you said.
All right, let's go to audience questions now. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Looks like we already have our first question. I'll go to you, caller. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. So my question is for Melissa. Regarding the time, place, and manner intent for the statute, what's to say that Facebook is any different from, say, going to church? Understandably, whenever a sex offender, you know, goes to a playground or a Chuck E. Cheese, the time, place, and manner restriction is there specifically because you cannot go to any of those places without the exclusive purpose of meeting children. So I understand the justification is that it's, you know, an unavoidable result that you'll meet children on Facebook, but how is that any different from, say, a church? Could the state then, under that logic, block someone from attending a church? Because they're going to have the same access of information at a church, you know, member directories have phone numbers and pictures, addresses, things like that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good question, and I like the Chuck E. Cheese and the park reference, because I do think in some ways for our, the younger generation, Facebook is the new parks and the new, I don't know if I would go so far as Chuck E. Cheese, but I think of it as sort of the new park or the new playground or the new mall where kids congregate, you know, often without having to leave their house. And so I actually think that is the right analogy, and there are laws on the books that do restrict sex offenders and previously convicted and released sex offenders from having access to certain areas. In fact, from living in certain areas, you know, whether or not those are problematic in other respects. You know, there are residency restrictions in certain states for sex offenders that prohibit them from living in certain areas close to schools, for example. And so I think there is that analog. Now, you know, you're right. There are other areas like churches where I think it could implicate different interests, and you could, you know, there's obviously religious freedom concerns that come with access to churches. And there are kids at churches, and you could have similar arguments. And I actually don't know, and maybe someone else on the call does, but I don't know if that has come up or played out in terms of the other restrictions that do exist for sex offenders, like residency restrictions. I'm not sure how they're worded, if they're worded in a way to exclude religious institutions. I don't know, Jonathan, if you have any idea, but I do think, you know, the way to look at it and the way to think of it, you know, in our modern world, as things change, we find ourselves sort of looking for older world analogs to try to make comparisons. And I think viewing sites like Facebook and other social networking sites as the modern day equivalent of the park or you know, other meeting places, you know, is a fair way to try to analyze the issue.
Great. Well, I'll make another call for questions. Remember to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. I'll also make a brief announcement about our upcoming programming. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Thursday, February 23rd at 1 p.m. That call will feature an update on the Walgreens stockholder litigation. The call will feature Ted Frank, who is a senior attorney and director at the Center for Class Action Fairness at CEI. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforums, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming teleforum conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, I'll ask one of my own. Jonathan, why is the First Amendment the first thing that states confront in cases like these?
Because it's easy. Because it's rational to do so. Justice Holmes once said in I think it was the Abrams dissent in 1919, persecution for the expression of opinion is perfectly logical or seems perfectly reasonable, and the state has a big problem that Melissa really very clearly laid out. It's a problem that technology now doesn't solve, as you can analogize, for example, Facebook, parts of Facebook, to a modern-day church, it's really not. We like this form of communication precisely because we can use it in ways we can't use more traditional forms of communication. In church, you can't disguise yourself as a kid and offer candy. In church, you can't, it's not socially acceptable to talk to someone, to get private information out of someone by manipulating them. This mode of communication presents problems. And I'm not one of these sort of First Amendment lawyers that thinks that you ought to, you know, that speech is some non-dangerous thing that is platonically separate from conduct, as our discussion after Melissa corrected me on the level of scrutiny showed.
Corrected.
but I do think that it's very easy. I do think that democracy is a problem, has been a problem for people who believe in practical solutions to things, because it it relies on speech. And so when you go to speech, when you in this case, when you think you are certain about what your outcome is, when you're certain that someone who is registered in this database is a kind of person, when in fact he or she may not be, you think going to speech, I mean, going to what they say is the easiest way to sort of socially dismember them. And that is why the court has, I mean, that's one reason, not the only reason, because there are many historical reasons and cultural reasons, but that's one reason why you often see legislatures, at least sort of first generation, pre-Reno, right? Between the 1940s and the 1990s, after a good bit of First Amendment law after New York Times versus Sullivan, you see legislatures repeatedly taking what looks like the easy way out, stopping someone from speaking, from being heard, from participating socially, is the easy way out. The fact that this statute does it in a way that is astonishingly broad, and at least as defended in the state Supreme Court, unapologetically so, is a new twist here. But the impetus, the impulse to find an outcast, to find a problem, an anarchist, or someone who says "fuck the draft" on a jacket on his or her back, or someone who burns a cross or has a Klan rally, the impetus to go after a dissenter is true of any of democratic societies as well as totalitarian ones, and that's what legislatures tend to do instinctively, uniquely in democracies, I think, because they are responsive when they are trying to solve a social problem. Let's go after this person. That is one of the reasons, in my view anyway, these cases come up and keep coming up.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions, would you both like to make some closing remarks?
Ladies.
Sure. Thanks. I think we've covered a lot here. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens at the argument. I think Jonathan's absolutely right that a lot of the questions directed at North Carolina will be about the actual scope of the statute. I think the sort of more important long-term question, though, is whether, if you assume for a moment that it is limited to sites like Facebook, whether it is narrowly tailored. Because, you know, the fact is that states and the federal government have been, for a long time now, sort of developing and refining and passing new laws to address issues with respect to sexual abuse of children, with respect to sex offenders. There are a number of other states that have similar laws in the books or perhaps are contemplating similar laws. And so I think as far as this legislation goes going forward, what the court has to say about this particular statute, whether it upholds it or whether it strikes it down, I think more the parameters that it sets forth with respect to the North Carolina statute will really be important for other states in deciding how to address or how they can address this issue going forward. And so I think, you know, whatever the court does, it will say a lot about the bounds of the First Amendment. And as Jonathan said, you know, how states can respond to real social problems without upsetting the sanctity we have with respect to free speech in this country. And so it'll be interesting to see what lines the court draws, regardless of what the ultimate outcome is here.
Just two quick comments. The first is I agree completely with everything you just said, not just the parts that were kind to me. The This is a very, in one sense, this looks like an easy case. And a lot of us were caught off guard by it because it's really, on its face, a very bizarre statute to think would ever get to the Supreme Court. And I'm not going to speculate on why it was so broad. And I don't know as much as many people on this call may know about the political difficulties that currently envelop North Carolina, in this area in terms of gender identity. But this kind of statute is a surprise. And so sort of the first thing that the first sort of conclusion is that to the extent the Supreme Court is a teacher of that argument, is a teacher of social values, a helper in understanding the role of citizens, which is something that I think would be helpful at this point in our history, this case is of enormous symbolic cultural importance. To hear this argument will be important. To see how the court writes about a statute that's so broad and yet is subject to not as demanding a kind of a standard of scrutiny as it should be, is kind of to me going to be very important for future cases. And the second thing is you know, I don't want to discount, and I think constitutional First Amendment lawyers often do discount the harm caused by that this is trying to address. There's a tendency among sort of liberals to, and I'm one, by the way, to assume that, you know, down there in North Carolina, they don't know how to address the statute, so they'll just shut everybody up. And I don't think that's true. I mean, I see this, the question of using the internet as a place where people with less savvy, younger, less power can be preyed upon as a very serious social problem. But solving that problem by making assumptions about another powerless group strikes me as a unique thing about this statute. I'm not speaking for sexual abusers, but I am speaking for people who do their time, try and change. And that's what we're trying to do. When someone commits a crime, no matter what we think of the validity of the statute that under which the person is convicted, as in this case, and serves time fully, that's the end of the story. When we agree as a society that that doesn't mean that person doesn't relinquish certain, he has to relinquish certain features of privacy and must register, I don't have a problem with that either. But I do have a real problem being kind of, you know, with sort of forcing victims of sexual predation to sort of constantly plug holes as though they were playing whack-a-mole, because they'll never catch up to the internet, even if Moore's Law stops working. Everything, you know, the internet will keep changing. It will keep sort of technology will keep advancing. These problems are not going to go away. So because of that, we really have to be careful, not just doctrinally, as I said, as was my first point. I think we as a society should be careful, particularly because tension is high right now in sort of political culture. We have to be careful about how we make assumptions about categories of people. And doing that without completely obliterating this presumption in favor of speech that I was talking about it's very hard, but it's sort of the nub here. You can't punish people because of what they say. Someone on Facebook, and I don't think it's very hard. I don't think the Facebook news issue is all that hard. Facebook is competing with the New York Times now. Someone on Facebook who praises God because he has been struck with luck 20 years after he made a mistake that he's paid for and has trouble living in neighborhoods because he's something he did 20 years ago that he has to cop to. That person, that person should he shouldn't be thought of in a particular way because he shouldn't be punished for that. And this statute, I think, as limited, would punish him. As limited, as narrowed as Melissa was describing it. So this case is an interesting parallel of political culture now, and it's worth following it for that reason, as well as for some of these sort of technical, without diminishing them, doctrinal questions that that are going to be affected by this decision.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.